everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Susanna Drake, who teaches at McAllister College. Here to talk about her new book, Slandering the Jew, Sexuality and Difference in Early Christian Texts, published in 2013 by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Susanna, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thank you so much.
I'm glad to have you. So maybe you can set the stage for us a little bit. What period are we talking about when we talk about early Christianity? Sort of where is the action taking place? And who are some of the early church fathers whose names we should know?
Great question. So the period that I cover in the book is largely from the first century of the Common Era. And that's the era when Jesus and Paul lived, both Jews, by the way. And the book goes up through about the turn to the turn of the fifth century of the Common Era. So through the age of what we would begin to call, often called the patristic period or the time of the church fathers. And so Paul is one of the main figures in the book, but then there are also some figures who might be lesser known to the general public, figures like Origen of Alexandria, very important third century biblical interpreter and Christian theologian, and John Chrysostom, which many people would recognize that name. And he was a bishop of Constantinople and also a priest in Antioch in the fourth century. So those are a couple of the important names that are tracked in the book and help you get a span of the time I'm thinking about too.
Mm-hmm. So you look at how you look at the Jewish construction, the construction of Jews as sexual perverts, really, in writings by Greek church fathers from the first to fifth centuries. What were some of the representations of Jewish sexuality in these early writings that you identified?
So something that comes up fairly early in the Christian tradition, and this is after the time of Paul, who wrote in the mid first century, but by the second and third centuries, we begin to get this trope, this idea that Jews are carnal and that they're more bodily or attached to the flesh in a way that that opposes the way that Christians are attached to the spirit. So this carnal versus spiritual dichotomy begins to be mapped on to Jewish-Christian difference, where Jews are the carnal ones, and guess what? Christians are the spiritual ones. And that begins to happen fairly early on in texts like the Epistle of Barnabas and the writings of Justin Martyr. And what I was interested in, one of the things I was interested in this book, is showing how that trope developed alongside two other developments in early Christianity. First, the interpretation of the Bible. So how do Christians begin to appropriate and interpret the Jews' Bible, or what they considered the Christians' Old Testament? How do they appropriate that and begin to say that this is our text too, and actually this text is about Christ? One of the ways they do that is to say, Christians are the proper interpreters of the Old Testament. We read it spiritually. The Jews, the other, and heretics, they read it literally or carnally. So that's one of the developments I was interested in. And the second is the development of Christian asceticism, this idea that that true Christians, or Christians attempting to attain perfection, would do so in a way to pursue bodily purity, often through renunciation of sex and family and wealth, and this idea that ascetic practices, whereby one denied one's body, would somehow get you closer to the spirit. So biblical interpretation and the development of Christian asceticism are two of the places that I looked for this horrible development of the trope of Jews as carnal. And by the time we get into the fourth and fifth centuries, this is a very common trope, and it's accompanied with other horrible stereotypes, including accusations of being bestial or animal-like, fleshly, inebriated, drunken, gluttons, and sexual deviants of all kinds. The women are prostitutes, the men are alternatively too soft or hyper-masculinized or hypersexualized. And so it's and that type of stereotyping of the other, as I point out in the book, was not new to the ancient world, nor is it foreign to our world today.
Right. So how did they decide when to portray Jewish men specifically as either aggressively sexual or as effeminate and weak? Isn't it sort of a contradiction to portray the same group as sexual predators, but also as effeminate?
Yes. And the church fathers often had no problem with contradiction. They would use whatever stereotype was suiting them at the time. So when the Christians, and this happened often before Christianity became the religion of the state in the late 4th century, often Christians would portray themselves as the weak victim, the sheep, right, that were oppressed by either the Romans or oppressed by heretics in their midst or oppressed by powerful Jews. And when they were working with that type of discourse, the kind of oppressed Christian and the Christian as victim and the victimizers, everybody else around them, all their opponents, they would sometimes call to mind this image of the hypersexualized Jew in pursuit of pure Christian, often women. So this Christians were feminized, their Jews were masculinized. It's interesting as it shifts to the as Christianity gains more power and as the Roman Empire itself is Christianized, we begin to see less of that rhetoric and a little bit more of the rhetoric of Jews are deviant in other ways, including, for example, John Chrysostom's first sermon against the Jews, in which he says Jewish men are malicose, soft or luxurious or effeminate. So he kind of talks about them in that sphere. But in the same sermon, he goes to the other side and says they're hypersexualized or they're gluttons or drunkards. And he brings whatever stereotype he wants to bear to try to prove to his congregation that Jews are people to stay away from.
Why did early church fathers feel the need to do this? Didn't they share scripture and practices with Jews? Or was it precisely because they shared so much they felt they needed to distinguish themselves?
You know, I think you're right on that second point, that it was the very proximity and overlapping of their interests and their scriptures and their theologies and their practices. The fact that in all these centuries that we're talking about, you had people who were attending both church services and synagogue services. That there were, I think, many people who we could term some kind of hybrid, both Jew and Christian, and that we see in the writings of the elite fathers that have been handed down to us an attempt to try to draw a borderline between the Jews and the Christians, between church and synagogue, between different practices, between different ways of interpreting the Bible. So I think in many cases that we can trace this, if you say this need or this impulse to stereotype and to denigrate, I think that can often be traced to these very communities where there is proximity between the communities and overlapping interests. And it's sometimes in the close-knit communities that you see some of the most virulent rhetoric.
Yeah, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what hybridity is and why it's so scary. It seems like in a lot of instances where there's unclear boundaries, people get particularly scared.
Yes. No, I agree with that. And hybridity, it's a complicated theoretical term, so I'm probably not going to do it justice here. But I like to think of it as not just a kind of mixing or overlap, but the hybrid is a figure that points to the instability of the two poles, right? Mm-hmm. So the hybrid, for lack of a better term here, we could say Christian Jew or Christian Jewish Roman Hellenized person. And that points to the very, the very instability of those categories as univocal or somehow bounded categories, Christian, Jew, Roman, Greek. These were all things that all categories of identity that in this period we're talking about, late antiquity, were contested and overlapping and often incommensurable. So I think hybridity in the book becomes a useful term for me to try to think about the complicated nature of the landscape, especially in regard to identity.
I want to come back to something you mentioned, the relationship between carnality and sort of literal interpretation of the Bible.
Yes.
It seems like the early church leaders are saying, you know, not only are Jews sexual, but because they're sexual, they misread the Bible. Was the charge of sexual, you know, so the charge of sexuality such a potent one because it allowed for this textual differentiation?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And here's the argument is very circular. Often in the place where this argument occurs, the church leader will say something like, the Jews are so carnal because they don't understand their own scripture and they read it in a literal bodily way. According to the desires of the flesh, is what Epistle of Barnabas says. And then in the same breath, they'll say, the Jews read their scripture incorrectly because they are so carnal. So it creates this kind of circular argument that you can see that it doesn't hold much water. And but it's that kind of correspondence of those two things where I really see the development of this trope of the carnal Jew seems to me to be in its beginning stages, coupled with the accusation that Jews misunderstand their own scripture. And so in a way, it's coupled with an exegetical claim on the part of Christians, a claim of the Bible as their own.
So how successful were the early church fathers in painting the Jews in this way? I mean, what were some of the ramifications?
So this is something that I would love if I or other people after me could do more research on. In the book, I became very interested in, as I was writing, I became interested in the relationship of this rhetoric to acts of violence in what we might call the real world, or material, what are the material or social effects of this kind of rhetoric, right? So when John Chrysostom preaches to his congregation and has all these horrible stereotypes of Jews, what happened as a result of that? Is there, what are the ways that we can trace anti-Judaism in these other fields besides just the discursive? And there, I think things get a lot trickier. One avenue that I tried to somewhat open up in the book is to think about legal moves once the empire was Christianized, or once the interests of the empire dovetailed with the interests of the church. Were there legal restrictions placed on Jews that might be seen as somewhat justified by the stereotypes of Jews coming from church leaders? And then actual instances of violence, mob violence, for example, the burning of synagogues, forced conversions of Jews. And definitely as you go into the medieval world, we have more evidence of these sorts of acts. And you can see there in the literature as well the recurrent use of these tropes of Jews as carnal and sexualized. And I think there we have, I think it's an interesting project to trace that, the links between violent speech, or what we might now call hate speech, and violent acts.
It does seem like sexual deviance is sort of in the eye of the beholder. What do Jewish texts have to say about this kind of sexuality?
So, since I'm not an expert on Jewish texts, I would point your listeners to the book by Daniel Boyarin called Carnal Israel, where he looks at Talmudic attitudes, so attitudes by the on the part of the rabbis towards marriage, sexuality, the body. And he actually begins that book in the introduction quoting Augustine, whom I quote in my book as well, on, you know, kind of behold carnal Israel. The reason the Jews are so carnal is because they don't understand their scripture. That's kind of echo of what we've heard a lot so far. And so Daniel Boyarin quotes that and says this is a trope in this time period, and then goes on to read the rabbinic text and say in many ways the rabbinic readings, so what became Jewish Orthodoxy, rabbinic Judaism, in many ways these texts were displayed different, and I think to simplify things, more positive valuations of the body or marriage or sexuality, and that in comparison to late ancient Christian texts. And so I think there's important differences. There are important differences to trace there, and some continuities as well. And so I would point listeners to the work, not only of Daniel Boyarin, but also Naomi Colton Frome is another good person to read, to think about Jewish attitudes towards marriage, sexuality, bodies, etc.
Where is gender in all this? It seems like, you know, you start the book with a story and there's a couple of other instances where the Christian writers are worried about their women. What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on? Right. One of the arguments that I make in the book, not only are the categories of Jew and Christian kind of created, and they're in the process of creating the categories Jew, Judaism, Christian, Christianity in this time period, they're also in the process of creating categories of male and female. And so I believe all these categories are in many ways socially made, socially constructed. And So there's a way to read the anti-Jewish material that I rehearse in the book as part and parcel of the construction of gender and sexuality in late antiquity. And I think vice versa, we can go to some of the writings on sexuality and asceticism and read there the construction of Christian identity and Jewish identity. So the claims that kind of, as you put it, this kind of claim or identification on the part of the church fathers occasionally with the feminized side, right? When they want to portray themselves as victim, they'll often portray, Chrysostom does this, Origen does it as well. You portray the Jews as the kind of aggressive male in pursuit of the pure Christian female. And this happens. One of my entry points into this book was Christian interpretations of the Jewish apocryphal story of Susanna and the elders. And this story is kind of, you have the pursuit of this Jewish matron, Susanna, who is innocent and honest, the pursuit of her by these kind of evil, lascivious Jewish elders, and an accusation of which she is finally cleared by the wise judgment of Daniel. And in the appropriation of that story, there was often an identification of the church with the Jewish matron, interestingly enough, and the synagogue would then be identified with the Jewish elders who were licentious and depraved and dishonest in so many ways. So there, I think you get this kind of interesting feminization of the church and masculinization of Judaism where it suits the purposes of the church fathers. And in other places, the church fathers will portray themselves as the strong men who have control of their wives, and look at the poor Jews, who the Jewish men don't have control of their wives, and their wives are, you know, dancing barefoot in the streets, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, the story of Susanna and the elders is an interesting one in chapter 3, where we sort of see the categories of male and female being constructed. One area where I thought the construction of the category of Jew was particularly potent was in Justin Martyr's dialogue. Maybe you could tell us about that from chapter 1.
Yeah, so Justin Martyr writes one of his most famous pieces is this dialogue with Trypho. And it's not an actual recording of an interview that he had with the Jew Trypho. It's a highly rhetorical construction on Justin's part. This is in the 2nd century, so very early on. And Justin Martyr, by the way, the tradition remembers him as a martyr. It's not that his last name is just Martyr. It's that the tradition remembers him as that, since he was writing and potentially a part of a persecution of Christians in the 2nd century. So he writes this this dialogue with Trypho, where he talks about his upbringing as a pagan and his kind of flirtation with all sorts of philosophies, Stoic, Platonic, and then he is also interested in Judaism, but he finally, Christianity finally wins the heart of Justin, and he writes this dialogue with this rhetorical figure, probably invented, named Trypho, and in so doing is basically justifying Christianity over and against Judaism. And so it's this early site for the beginning stages of anti-Jewish rhetoric in a way that you could say this is stronger anti-Jewish rhetoric than that which we get in the New Testament, even though it repeats and develops some of the New Testament's claims.
Yeah. Chapter 2 looks at origin of Alexandria. Who was he, and how did he continue and expand the construction of Jews and sexuality that you talk about in chapter 1?
So Origen is one of my favorite people to study. He is a 3rd century theologian. He grows up in Alexandria, which is just this hotbed for intellectual exchange. You know, he's schooled in languages. He does translation work. He teaches. He has a female patron who supports him. He writes homilies. He's very, very productive. And he moves fairly early in his life. He moves to Caesarea Maritima in Palestine. And another community, another urban cosmopolitan community where you can imagine these overlapping communities of Jewish intellectuals, Christian intellectuals, pagan intellectuals. And so he writes in this very rich environment and really is one of, I mean, even though he's remembered as a heretic, he is one of the formers of Christian orthodoxy in many ways. And so the reason he was so important to my work in this book, I believe, is because he helped to solidify, or it's not solid at this point, but he helps to bring along the tradition of Christian biblical exegesis. So emphasizing spiritual Christian reading, what does that look like? And he describes it in homilies and commentaries on biblical books, and he's left behind numerous ones of these. He also has a book on first principles, which kind of lays out his method for biblical interpretation. And that's really one of the places you can begin to see this separation of literal reading from spiritual reading. And, you know, in the 20th and 21st century, we hear a lot about the privileging of literal readings of the Bible. Well, that was not the case in the ancient world. They, figures like Origen often thought the literal reading was kind of the first stage, the kind of baby or toddler stage of reading, and that through the practice of becoming a more spiritual Christian, one also was able to attain a stage of deeper spiritual understanding of the Bible. And for the interpretation of what he would call the Old Testament, this included the understanding of almost everything in the Old Testament as pointing to Christ, that there were types of Christ, like Isaac is a type of Christ, for example, and that the prophets were all prophesying about Christ. So Origen is one of the people who really lays out in a pretty methodical way how to do that kind of biblical interpretation. And so along with that comes this trope of that true Christians read in a spiritual way. And the best way to, one of the ways to understand that is to look at the Jews who read in a lesser way than Christians do, according to Origen. That is, the Jews read in a carnal, literal way. They pay attention to what he calls the soma, the body of Scripture. And they, Jews can't attain, he claims, the spirit of Scripture, which for him is Christ.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, in chapter 4, you look at John Chrysostom's sermons against the Jews. And there it seems like the frequency and level of invective just skyrockets. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the things that sort of stick with you from some of those sermons.
Yeah, I wish these things didn't stick with me because they're horrible images. You're right. The rhetoric really skyrockets with Chrysostom. And he's writing, or I think these sermons are from 386 and 387. He's a priest in Antioch at the time. And he writes against all sorts of heretics, but he says he's interrupting a sermon against one heretical group to tackle a disease that has basically infected his church, and that disease is the disease of Judaism. And so in a series of 8 sermons, he kind of lays out his case against Jews and so-called Judaizers. So in Chrysostom's view, Judaizers are people who may identify themselves as Christian, who come to church, but who are encouraging people in the church to also do Jewish things, Jewish practices, attending Sabbath or celebrating the Jewish holidays, observing kosher food laws. So he calls these what we might also term hybrid figures, Judaizers. And he thinks that this is the kind of way, one of the ways through which the disease of Judaism is spreading in his church. I mean, he really paints it in highly binarized, like good versus evil language, something that also is not so unfamiliar to us today, those of us who live in the U.S. in 2016. And so I think that we do with Chrysostom see some of the worst stereotypes that we have seen thus far in the Christian tradition. And this, you know, this kind of stereotyping continues, as I said, into the medieval world and into the modern one. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was to expose how a stereotype such as that of the carnal Jew is made. So how does this type of hatred or hate speech, how does it start? What contributes to it? What's the context around which it develops? And to just kind of expose it as a stereotype so that you can begin to undo it. And I think Chrysostom's sermons are a good place to go to see the development of some of the worst kinds of anti-Jewish stereotypes that are not unfamiliar to those who lived through 20th century.
Mm. Well, Susanna, we've taken up a lot of your time, so any parting thoughts you'd like to share, and what are you working on next?
Oh, yeah. Well, parting thoughts, let me just think. For those of you interested in Jewish and Christian relations in the ancient world and in the late ancient world, there's a very nice online resource now. Let me just give it a plug, the Ancient Jew Review at ancientjewreview.com. And that's one of my favorite sites now to go to see forums, online forums and scholarly discussions of this type of material. It's started by some Columbia and Yale graduate students. And for my next project, for the project I'm currently hard at work on, it's a project on veiling practices in early Christianity. So not only women's head coverings and thinking about debates about veiling before the rise of Islam, but also the use of veils and textiles and curtains in Christian ritual and in Christian art.
Susanna, that sounds like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. The book is Slandering the Jew, Sexuality and Difference in Early Christian Texts, published in 2013 by the University of Pennsylvania Press. The author is Susanna Drake. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.